You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 348, A Relevance Theory Approach with John Hilber. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Happy Halloween, Mike.
Oh, happy Halloween. And it is. You know, we have, I can't remember if I've, you know, made this known, but one of our pugs, we almost lost one of our pugs. So he is back and in full health now.
That's good.
Little Norman. So yeah. It is a happy Halloween for us.
Well, that's good. That's good. What are you dressing up as this year?
What am I dressed? Well, I always say I'm going as the adult.
A scholar. So, you dressing up
as that's a costume I wear every year. You know, our kids are grown, so we're not like going to any like church kids get candy sorts of things. You know, there's no trick or treat thing. It's a new, although my wife did put out a giant glowing sort of Halloweenish dog in our yard and a pumpkin. So we're doing something, but nobody's dressing up actually.
I may go as a COVID spreader.
And what does that look like?
Somebody
you're
with
in
no
plain
mask on.
Clothes without a mask. Yeah. Is that what that is?
That's it. Exactly. Although I should put on our Naked Bible mask. Have you been wearing the Naked Bible mask?
I have. Yeah. I have, you know, in at work, you know, it's one of, I rotate masks. There's my Green Bay Packers mask. There's my pug mask. And then there's my Naked Bible mask.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah. Hey, I've gotten several pictures of people wearing their Naked Bible mask. So I appreciate that. Email me at treystrickland@gmail.com if you have some of those pictures, and I'll post it on Facebook and whatnot. But yeah, that's awesome. That's good stuff. Well, you brought up Green Bay Packers, Mike, and we play this weekend.
Yeah.
But at the time of this recording, we don't know the final outcome. So hopefully I'm beating you.
Yeah. Well, we'll see. We'll see.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, my team's in trouble. You know, what can I say? We'll just see.
Well, hopefully besides announcing me as the winner of that game, we could go ahead and announce the winner of our voting for our next book study, and that's Old Testament and Revelation, Mike.
What a shocker.
Get ready. Your favorite.
What a shock.
Your favorite book coming up.
Hey, you know, this is a good compromise because I get to do something with this book that everybody asks for every week. and yet avoid the prophecy quagmire, you know, the silliness / quagmire. I mean, both of those words are at times appropriate. So I don't have to get into all that, but we can spend a lot of time in the book of Revelation. So it's a good compromise.
Absolutely. Well, I'm thrilled and I'm looking forward to it. Well, this week, Mike, we've got an old friend on. We've had on several times, either at ETS or he was at our Naked Bible Conference, and John Hilber.
Yeah, this episode with John is actually sort of a culminating event that arose out of a conversation, you know, that we had with John at the academic meetings, you know, and we recorded and put on the podcast earlier. He finished a book on the Old Testament cosmology and divine accommodation, this idea that God accommodates himself, you know, to the writers to communicate. And he's approaching it through something that linguists call relevance theory. And it's a model. It's a model of how communication works that includes what I would call worldview, but again, more technically, linguists and other scholars would refer to it as a writer's cognitive environment. You know, how we can learn the writer's cognitive environment, his worldview, and then make it part of our own, you know, for the sake of biblical interpretation. So it's real familiar stuff conceptually, you know, to what we talk about here on the podcast a lot. But now we've actually got a book that is going to address the subject. It's an academic book. You know, parts of it are, you know, going to be, you know, pretty steep, you know, for those who are not sort of used to reading that kind of material. But there's really not anything else like it. And, you know, John is very sensitive. He was a pastor for part of his career. He's very sensitive to being able to make, you know, these ideas digestible. So, you know, the book's going to serve that purpose, and certainly this interview will serve that purpose. Well, we're excited to have John Hilber on the podcast. For some of the people acquainted with the podcast, I mean, we get new people all the time, but a lot of you will already know his name. He spoke for us at the Naked Bible Conference. And, you know, I have mentioned his work in several respects, you know, on various episodes, but we finally get a chance to have John here to actually sort of, you know, really do a deep dive into something that came up during an SBL interview. I had a short chat with John that we, you know, uploaded to the podcast when he was working on this book. And we're going to talk about his book. You know, we'll give you the title and how to get it, and there will be a pretty significant discount to it. But first, I want to ask John to introduce himself to the audience, because, again, we have a lot of new people that join our audience really on a regular basis. So, John, why don't you just tell everybody who you are?
Okay. Thank you, Mike, first for having me on your show. It's an honor to be with you and to also have a one-way conversation, at least, with some pretty serious Bible students out there. I started my life as a geology major at University of Washington and got my BS in geology, but the Lord called me in other directions, meaning seminary and vocational Christian ministry. But I never left behind my interest in, you know, issues of science, which led me into the book ultimately. But I went off to Dallas Seminary for my THM in Semitics and Old Testament, and then I spent the first half of my life in pastoral ministry. So I understand, you know, at a very practical level what this is all about. And halfway through my career, I had a midlife crisis, so to speak. Instead of buying a sports car and some gold chains, I put up a whole lot of money to go back to school. Cost about the same as a Corvette Stingray, I guess, to pay tuition. So I think it was a better investment. So I went off to Cambridge and did a PhD in Old Testament and Ancient Near Eastern Studies, and then taught for 8 years at Dallas Seminary, and left there in 2012 to head north again to Grand Rapids Theological Seminary, where I have been since then teaching Old Testament. I do Hebrew language, exegesis, hermeneutics, even some spiritual formation coursework as well with our students. Like I said, I've always maintained an interest in geology and science, and that sort of meshed with my Old Testament studies in a natural sort of way, which brought me to this whole area of, you know, of ultimately relevance theory as part of a help in teaching us to think through these issues of science in the Bible.
You realize what you've just done with that introduction. Somewhere, somebody out there in our audience is going to find a picture of you and Photoshop you in next to a Corvette with some bling on.
Oh no!
With the caption of "What might have been."
Oh no! Well, I'm
you're in trouble now.
Yeah, I'm rather naive on these media sorts of things at my age, so I guess I got what's coming to me.
Yeah, there you go. Oh boy. Well, you know, the title of your book is what? Give everybody the title of your book, and then I want to say a few things to kind of set up how we're going to talk about this. Go ahead.
Okay. The title is Old Testament Cosmology and Divine Accommodation, subtitled A Relevance Theory Approach.
Yeah. You know, so there you have, you know, this audience is going to be familiar with the issues of Old Testament cosmology and the descriptions. They're also going to be familiar with the notion, the concept, at least, of accommodation, because of some of the things we talk about and, you know, come up in different episodes and Q&As, you know, that God is going to stoop, condescend, whatever word, accommodate himself is the most common, to you know, to the human writers, allowing them to do the task that he has set before them. You know, so again, in very general, simplistic terms, you know, they're going to be accustomed to that idea. And I wanted to have you on because this is a really important topic. Now, before I forget it, yes, you know, for the listeners, you will be able to get John's book at a 40% discount. You go to the WIF and Stock website. That's the only place you can get this. You cannot get the discount at Amazon. That is WIF and Stock, and that's spelled WIPF, the word and then STOCK, whiffandstock.com. And you put in a code. The code is Divine, D-I-V-I-N-E. Trey's going to have all this on the episode website, episode webpage. But again, just to prime the audience here, this is a really important topic. The book is going to be for people who are interested in hermeneutics. How do we interpret scripture? Everybody talks a lot about interpreting the Bible in context, but we often restrict that idea to history, maybe some cultural practices. What your book does is get people into the worldview and to use a phrase that shows up a lot in your book, the cognitive environment of the writers. And I'm of the opinion that this would be a very valuable book to teach, or really to require, you know, in the course of teaching a hermeneutics class. But for those in our audience who don't get to pick the textbooks if they are in school, most of our audience just, you know, are lay people who care and pastors who care. I want people to know that it's not what I'd call an easy read. I mean, it's going to be serious content, but I think it is accessible, and it will get us into the questions of how do we handle this sort of language in the Old Testament? And on the way, it also answers the question of why should we care about ancient Near Eastern and Second Temple cognitive environments? You know, we in this audience, we almost think that's self-evident. Like, what an absurd question. But I still, to this day, get the question. You know, why should I care about this external stuff to the Bible? What good is it? So, you know, your book is, I think, a very good way to get us into all of these things. And so I want to sort of start off by, I guess, asking that last, you know, general question that, like I said, I still get. But if somebody were to send you an email or walk up to you, at, you know, at church, or maybe even a student in one of your classes, maybe they got stuck in your class, John, they have to take this class, and there's Dr. Hilbert in front of me, I can't escape. And they ask, you know, hey, why should we care about ancient Near Eastern or intertestamental Jewish material? Because, you know, hey, that stuff's outside the Bible. It sounds like you're recommending unbiblical books to teach us spiritual truths in the Bible. And that just doesn't make sense to me. So how would you respond to that just generally?
Yeah. Good starting question, Mike. We understand that there's a 2,000 to 4,000 roughly year gap between us and the original communication situation in which the authors of scripture are writing to an ancient audience. And as you mentioned, sort of the grammatical historical method of interpretation is what we all espouse, rightly so. But we give only lip service to the historical part, so that this historical gap that we all appreciate is important, because when Jeroboam sets up his cult shrines at Bethel and Dan in the north, we, you know, realize that there's something that's important about those locations, and that helps inform or enrich the meaning of the text and what it's saying about Jeroboam's initiatives, you know, to cut off the northern kingdom people from going down south to worship Yahweh at his chosen spot in Jerusalem. But when we move off into more subtle things, like let's say covenant treaty forms, we still say, okay, well, that's helpful. Literary forms are important, and the Book of Deuteronomy falls in this pattern of an ancient Near Eastern suzerain vassal treaty, and that helps enrich our understanding of what Moses is saying when he structures Deuteronomy according to this form. So we're fine with that. Then we stretch out a little more abstractly to, let's say, religious beliefs, and we look at Elijah engaging with Baal religion on Mount Carmel. And so we understand that when the prophets of Baal are gouging themselves, those are Baal worship rites. But where did we get that idea? We get that idea because we've read Ugaritic texts that talk about Canaanite religion, and they talk about the god Baal, who is gouging and cutting himself in mourning rites when he gets news that Baal is dead. And yeah, so we understand.
In other words, it wasn't from a movie scene.
Exactly. And so it's delving into these ancient Near Eastern texts, or if you're talking about New Testament, late Second Temple texts that give us really important background information that enriches the meaning of the biblical text so that we understand better what it is that the author is trying to communicate to us.
I like to tell people that, you know, and sometimes I joke and say, you might want to sit down before I say this, but, you know, biblical writers read books.
Right.
Like they were conversant with the intellectual discussion, you know, the content of a literate culture. You know, the people who produce the Bible are literate, and they produce it for literate people, and they engage with literate discussion of their own time. And so we should expect some sort of, you know, and I know it goes into different buckets, you know, why they would do what they do or utilize what they utilize, but we should at minimum expect there to be some sort of cross-fertilization or presence of these other ideas, you know, drifting around somewhere, either in the biblical text or that they would be very useful for, you know, helping us understand what a biblical writer actually wrote.
Yeah. And there's, you know, we probably don't want to get into it in this conversation, but, you know, my book, I have some pages on this, that there's some good archaeological evidence that lets us know that a lot of this ancient Near Eastern material was in circulation in the biblical period. And so they knew of this stuff and engaged and interacted with it. And a lot of it actually, I think, worked down even to the popular level that the, you know, the average Israelite would have absorbed it just like, you know, we absorb a lot of, let's say, Eastern religious traditions about meditation and such, because it's just in the popular culture. It's in the air that we breathe. And therefore,
especially if it's communicated by story.
Yes.
That's easy to transmit.
Yep. So our media educates us, and we tell stories to our kids when they're growing up. I mean, who has really read Grimm's fairy tales? Well, not very, you know, there's an occasional English literature nerd that has, but, you know, most of us just sort of learned it on the laps of our mothers. So we all know the Grimm stories, even though we've not actually read the literature itself. It's in the air we breathe, and therefore it's what we say. It's in the cognitive environment in which we exist.
Yeah, and even, you know, Shakespeare. How about the Bible? I mean, lots of people who've never read the Bible are familiar with certain points of its content, you know, especially, right, you know, certain stories. And I that's a good illustration you offered there, because, you know, people have discussions, you know, they go over to other people's houses and they have meals and they talk about things and they tell stories and, you know, this is just normal life. You know, it's just a feature of human interaction, and it doesn't change or go away. I should say, it doesn't go away when you have people producing, you know, literature, okay, you know, biblical writers writing, they're still people.
Yeah, yeah. And if I can give an illustration of just how subtle and complicated this becomes, and this is where relevance theory helps us, because relevance theorists have looked very carefully at how human communication actually works in the real world, and the Bible, of course, is part of basic human communication. There's not some sort of special thing going on there. We learned long ago that there's not a special Holy Ghost Greek that the New Testament's written in. It's written in ordinary common Greek dialect of the day. And so God has accommodated himself to everyday conversation.
You mean it's not like the Matrix where, like, God plugged something into the back of their heads?
Exactly right.
Paul wakes up and says, I know Kung Fu now, you know?
Yeah. It doesn't work that way. And so it's not, in fact, I opened my book with the illustration. I had a conversation with a colleague coming out of chapel one day, and we were coming to the door of the office building, and I held an apple up in my hand, and I said, I'm going to keep the doctor away. And given the time of day right after chapel, it's lunchtime, and it wasn't very difficult for his brain, as marvelously as God has wired it, to infer from what I said, which is really only half of a common proverb. So he had to supply the other half of the proverb, an apple a day keeps the doctor away. And so he knew, the first half, something about eating apples, and I hold an apple up in my hand, and it's lunchtime, and he instantaneously, at the speed of the light, his neural processors put it all together, and he understands that I'm saying that I'm going to eat an apple for lunch. And and the success of my communication with him depended on the time of day and his assumption. I assume that he understands that the time of day is lunchtime. And I assume that he understood half of a popular proverb. And so he put that all together and knew what I was saying. And more subtly than that is we had been part of a conversation in a faculty meeting the day before. So we have brought in recent memory into the cognitive environment of that moment, where in the faculty meeting, we were discussing the very issue of how important are these issues of background on the conversation about what the Bible means. Mm-hmm. And he and I sort of lean in different directions, we could say, in emphasis. And so he knew that at an even deeper level, I was illustrating for him just how important and subtle cognitive environment can be to a normal communication process. And he smiled at me and chuckled because, I scored one on him there, and we're right. Friends. And so, I'm sure waited for his time to get me back at some opportunity. But that illustrates how, how there's this confluence of your situational setting, the time of day, an awareness of literary things like proverbs, physical objects in the environment, recent memories, things that are i.e. relevant to us, that help to put together useful understanding of communication.
Yeah, for our audience, I hope the next time I say on a podcast episode that, biblical writers, like let's just use an illustration. We've been doing a series on how the New Testament writers repurpose Old Testament. And I will say periodically things like, the New Testament writer sort of presumed that his reader would either be able to follow this bunny trail, or they would sort of mentally, detect what he's doing and why, because they just had the knowledge base to make that correction or connection. The writers can presume things of their readers that's not out of bounds, when it comes to what happens between the Testaments or biblical interpretation. It's a human thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it has validity. There are cases where that thing you wish you would see in the biblical text to quote unquote prove something. Well, one of the reasons it may not be there is because the writer didn't need it to prove anything. I mean, the audience just had it.
Mm-hmm.
And there are things that you can with a very high degree of certainty look at their situation and go, yeah, it's odds are very high that they would have, put those things in place mentally. And he didn't need to say that. They would have, caught the drift because it was part of a much larger, frequent, conversation about a particular idea. So that's a good illustration. I hope our audience remembers it. Before I ask you another thing, I just want to make sure that there might be somebody out there in the audience who needs to hear this, but you're not recommending that we replace the grammatical historical method of interpretation with something else. Okay, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. What relevance theory does is it helps us, I think, to understand from a more filled out modern communication model. It helps us to understand how the grammatical historical method actually works.
Mm-hmm.
In that it assumes, when we say historical, we mean more than just history. we really mean, and interpreters have always implicitly understood this, we mean anything that could be relevant as a background assumption to the communication in the Bible.
Right, right. A more clunky, maybe a little bit silly way to put that is relevance theory takes seriously the notion that the communicator and his audience are people who have functioning brains.
Yes.
That might sound a little silly or odd, but honestly, that's where we're at. It's not just this. And you actually, I think this is a word you actually use in a couple of places, but in the book, you get to talking about sort of the mechanical, I think maybe you use the word dictionary, like entry sort of method that we teach people, when in the course of doing, teaching them the grammatical historical method, we often sort of model for students that, oh, you're at this step, now you go look this up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
in a lexicon or in some reference book and those are important things to do, but they don't get you inside the head of the writer. There are things that those steps will do, but there are things that they can't do.
Yeah, we in fact, when we bring that whole topic up of sort of the linguistic side of things, and we just look up a word in the dictionary, that leads us to the first premise in all relevance theory is that humans have not only dictionary entries in their brains, but they also have encyclopedic entries in their brains. Right. So when I, every individual has a different encyclopedic entry. So if I say the word father, that immediately triggers a whole set of associations based upon my experience in life that might be somewhat different and unique. Well, not might be, it will be somewhat different and unique, say, from yours. Mike, I don't know your dad and I don't know your experiences any more than mine, but that necessarily has fed into this encyclopedic entry in our brain regarding a word that you could look up in the dictionary. And so when humans communicate with each other, we don't just exchange dictionary entries in a set grammatical formula.
Yeah.
We are actually triggering associations in our sort of shared assumptions that we have that are part of our communication process.
Yeah, some things that, will, within a culture, there will be some things in those encyclopedic entries that are going to show up in all the entries. If you had a million people write an encyclopedia entry of a term, there will be things in all of those entries that are present, but they will all have differences. I mean, that even occurs like with siblings, to use the,
yes,
go back to the word father. You're going to have commonalities that you can pretty well predict are going to be part of this coverage of whatever this term is, but there will invariably be differences. Especially if you're allowed to, think about something bigger than a sentence. The dictionary entry, one or two sentences. Well, that's your definition. Well, that's a whole lot different than, again, to use your metaphor of the encyclopedia entry, where you really try to cover an item far more exhaustively and in a far more nuanced way. And so you're going to have commonalities, but you're going to certainly have differences too.
And so that circles us full round to the question of the gap between us and the ancient audience is that, I can be grammatically proficient in classical Hebrew and I can have access to the best Hebrew dictionaries, but there's a difference between the encyclopedic entries that are in the mind of an ancient Israelite and the encyclopedic entry that is in my mind. And so what I tell my students is that what you want to do as an interpreter is try to reproduce in your brain the encyclopedic entry that then trains the instincts of interpretation to the same tuning as the ancient audience. Mm-hmm. So that, there are some common things that I know what father is, and so did Moses at one level. But there are lots of things that he understood that I didn't naturally pick up growing up. So So this whole business of shared encyclopedic entries is important, and that's what relevance theory does, is it tries to focus in on what are the shared assumptions between an author and their audience, and the words that an author uses would be designed to trigger important associations in the broader encyclopedic entry that then help to enrich the meaning of those words.
Well, I'm going to pick up on this, and you know, you can, I'm sure you'll be able to do it more justice than I can here. But using the dictionary entry versus the encyclopedia entry, dictionary entry, okay, you get a sentence or two. Let's get into the L word here, literalism.
Okay.
You know, because literalism is this sort of out of the box first meaning of a word that sort of pops into your head, really apart from even thinking about context. You know, when I use a word like hot, okay, there's, you know, to most people that's going to have something to do with temperature. Okay. That's just the default sort of place where they're going to land. I mean, we all have these, you know, immediate, again, reflexive dictionary level entry parsings of words. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I'm no different than a lot of people in my audience. You know, I was taught as a new believer, you should interpret the Bible literally. And I was glad, I think it was in your book. I mean, I've been reading a couple of other things about hermeneutics recently. So if this is not in your book, I don't want to disappoint anybody, but I think it's in your book. At one place you have you go to the old bromide, you know, if the plain sense makes sense, seek no other sense, and basically say, that's just terrible advice.
Oh, it is. Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And it is, I agree, but let's talk a little bit about literalism. You know, again, if I'm the person in church, I come up to you after the sermon, I shake your hand, I say, hey, don't you know we're supposed to interpret the Bible literally? Like, do you agree with that or not, Pastor?
Yeah, I don't. And in fact, people who are linguists, I mean, people whose profession is to study communication and how it works, they will say, I've read it with this exact expression, that the notion that we start with a literal interpretation, and then if that doesn't make sense, we start to, you know, move from the default to metaphorical meanings or whatever. And they call that a folk theory because it kind of makes sense. And sometimes we actually do that on occasion, especially when we are reading something in a context that we're not familiar with. We are a little bit baffled. And so we start somewhere. And I think because on occasion we do use that sort of mechanical method, we think that that's the way normal communication always works. Mm-hmm. But in fact, the human brain is not wired to do it that way. We don't start with an immediate dictionary entry and then start processing from there. What happens, and linguists have actually hooked people up to, you know, all of these electronic, you know, electrodes on the brain that sort of map the brain activity. And so they've studied in the lab how the brain works, and when a word is spoken, the whole brain lights up with what are presumed to be all of the potential options that are available for the meaning of that word. And then based upon the context, the brain shuts down the options and narrows them to, and this happens at nearly the speed of light or close to, the brain narrows down the options to the one that is the optimal fit for the context in which they are in. So let me just illustrate with the word you just used, hot. If we are standing outside in Texas or Florida in July, and you know, I just got off the plane and I'm, you know, wearing a sweater because it was cool and rainy in Michigan, and you said, John, it's hot. You know, John, you're hot. You know, you're talking about the thermal information, the thermal temperature. But if we are near the end of our podcast interview here, and you ask me, you know, John, what do you think of this guy? And I, you know, kind of just off the top of my head, shoot off a comment that maybe is not carefully or lovingly thought through, and then Trey jumps in and says, John, you're hot. you know, immediately I've got this microphone in front of me. You have a microphone in front of your face, and because of that new context, the recording session, I've got a microphone that right now I'm in front of. I would immediately know what he's thinking about, and I wouldn't have gotten there by thinking about thermal, gradients, so that the brain at the speed of light instantly processes all available options. And in fact, researchers have determined that if a metaphorical meaning is available and makes sense, that's what they default to. People actually default to metaphor before they default to the literal. And relevance theorists explain that as you're maximizing or optimizing the cognitive benefit of the words that that you're taking in.
You know,
so
that,
literal is not the default.
One of the things that validates how true that we default to the metaphorical is comedy. You know, because comedy is very easy to generate and pick up on. You know, when you see a skit or there's a scene in a movie or a TV show where conversation is parsed in a literal way, just, you know, out of the gate, and that it keeps going, and people will pick up on it very, very easily. And it doesn't even have to be crafted, you know, to do that, because as soon as the one character starts defining or understanding or comprehending everything, you know, literally, there's the comedy in that.
Yeah.
Because it's contrary to what we would normally do. That's why it's funny.
so for scholars who study hermeneutics and linguists, this is foundational across the board. Now, I've just used two metaphors there, and I doubt that your listeners for a second imagined a plank of wood or a concrete wall that underlies a building structure. When I said those words, they instantly, intuitively, at the speed of light, process what I was saying in an appropriate way.
So now everybody's rewinding now.
Exactly.
Hear that sentence again.
It's true. It's foundational across the board. You know what we're talking about here about, you know, literal
and boards. This is like this old house. You know, it just
exactly. Now,
it's a different show all of a sudden.
So, change context, and you might well default to the literal board or foundation if you change the context.
The obvious thing, you know, is people are going to be out there, well, like, how do we know? You know, how do we know when we're reading something, especially if it's so far removed from us, you know, in context, the cognitive environment of the writers and their original readers? Mm-hmm. How do we know when we're supposed to take something metaphorically? Because we're not them, we're not living there, and so our brain, we actually have to do some work. You know, it's not just gonna flash into our heads. So, you know, that's the obvious question: how do we know when we're supposed to move toward one or the other? Let me read something that you have in the book here, and maybe you can either unpack these terms or abandon your own quote. And go back to the initial question there.
Okay.
But in the book, you say several things about relevance theory in regard to this problem, you know, the literal versus, you know, something else problem. And you write, quote, "Relevance theory is not a method of interpretation. Rather, it is a model of communication that accounts for how different interpretations arise in various contexts. Relevance theory helps us think about what elements of the cognitive environment contribute to correct interpretation. And in terms of cognitive environment, relevance theory tries to help us engage the writer's cognitive environment, which you define as any information that is available to the ancient writer, and of course his audience, for mental processing." So can you unpack the elements of that? You know, like, how do we know? How do we know which way to move?
Go? Great question. It leads us into kind of the second and third foundational, metaphorically speaking, points of.
Wouldn't it be awful to have a conversation where you didn't use metaphor?
Well, see.
I mean, how could you do that?
Yeah, this plays right. Well, I'm getting a little ahead of here by a couple of minutes, but this plays right into what relevance theory says: is that we speak in a way that is optimal. We try to pack as much benefit into our communication, and the listener is tuned in to gain as much as they possibly can from the words that are said. But that's point three. The first point that I made was that relevance theory attends not just to dictionary entries, but encyclopedic entries. The second point is that those entries are organized in a degree of accessibility. So depending on the person's experiences, they might align their assumptions about the world in a different order of what is important. And I give the illustration of, if you're in an elevator, there's music playing in the background. We call it elevator music for a reason. It's because this is kind of the background. You don't pay attention to it. And so there's a conversation going on next to you. And so you're tuning into that because the conversation gets your attention, and the music that's playing is just, it's in the background. It's not readily accessible to you because of the priorities that you set up in the pecking order of things. But if the piece of music that comes on happens to be a song that was that you danced with your spouse at your wedding to, or maybe it was a song that your first love, and they broke up with you, and it smashed your heart, and there was a popular song on the radio, ballad that that's a heart wrencher. Immediately, you tune out the conversation going on next to you, and you attend to the music that's playing in the background because it has different relevance to you. And so the order of accessibility changes from individual to an individual, and also based upon the context. Mm-hmm. And so the third point is how that actually operates is we as human beings are wired to utilize the resources, whether it's food in our bodies or the sensory stimulus that comes into us from the world around us. We're just neurologically wired by God's grace, out of his goodness, to optimize, make the most that we can of the stimulus that we receive. Mm-hmm. And therefore, when we listen to something, we're trying to get as much out of that as we possibly can, unless we really think it's irrelevant and we tune it out. And so right now, some listeners said, I've had enough of this podcast. I've got better things to do. Mm-hmm. At that moment, the listener is making an optimal choice about what is most useful. And so we are in a normal communication process, we are constantly sort of realigning and reorganizing the pecking order of assumptions based upon the context that we're in. Am I getting off the plane when it's hot, mm-hmm. or am I recording mm-hmm. in front of a microphone, based upon context and what is going to be the most useful and meaningful to me, to either give me new information or to reinforce an assumption that I have, or perhaps correct a misassumption that I have. And so we optimize the cognitive benefits. And so what relevance theory does is it forces us to look at the original communication situation, not ours 2,000 to 4,000 years later, right. and to try to understand what would have been accessible assumptions to somebody in that situation, not in mm-hmm. the 21st century. Yep. I've got a different set of accessible assumptions than Moses or David had. And they had different sets of accessible assumptions than I have. And so relevance theory forces me to look at their accessible assumptions and to ask the question, how might they optimize the stimulus that they are given in, or at least their audience, in the words that are there in the text of Scripture or in the oral speeches where some of this began.
Yeah, so, again, by way of summary, and jump in and correct me if I, get any of this wrong. But, what you're saying is that the research indicates that our brains are hardwired in terms of conversation to default to metaphor, not, the encyclopedia entry, not the dictionary entry. And within that encyclopedia entry, our brains, because of our own context or contexts, will rank, will order that encyclopedia entry. And so our brain can sort of orient us to what is the most profitable, or, you know, the most important, you know, sense, the most important part of the encyclopedia entry, you know, that will either that will help us decide if this is useful or, you know, not, you know, or even right. rank in terms of usability. And that's just the way our brain works. That's just the way communication works. Is that about it?
Yeah, no, I think you nailed it. And so an illustration that's near and dear to your heart, and I think the heart of your audience as well, knowing what you've been teaching them, Genesis 1:26, a Christian reads, "Let us make humanity in our image," and they default to an assumption that that's Trinity. Mm-hmm. But those who know about divine counsel and are trying to put themselves in the place of the ancient audience, the most accessible default assumption is that us is speaking of the divine counsel. And so that illustrates how this, you know, temporal cultural gap can sometimes trip us up, and we miss things in the Bible that the original audience would have intuitively and without flinching would have picked up.
Right. You know, this is... I'll use the word address. This addresses a couple problems because, you know, we sort of intuitively, when we're asked to think about these things, I imagine a lot of people in the audience are thinking, you know, I've always wondered why I sort of, you know, default this way, or you know, I sort of always wondered how this works, because they can easily see how they don't default to the most literal thing. And if they listen to a conversation, whether it's live or on TV, they know intuitively that each speaker does not intend that their words be understood in the most literal way possible. And when you get people to see that, it's like, okay, you know, well, now I can sort of conceptually understand why this isn't the case. And then they can take a step to, well, if that isn't the way it works, then, you know, why should I be reading the Bible, you know, that way? So mm-hmm. that's the easy part. But this also brings to light the fact that since our brains default to the encyclopedia entry, but not all the encyclopedia entries are the same. Therefore, they're not going to be all ordered the same. They're not going to have all the same constituent elements. And even if they have similar or identical constituent elements along the way, the ordering might still be different. And so that brings up the question, How do you help someone? How do you help someone see something a certain way? And of course, we're talking about biblical interpretation. So how do mm-hmm. I rewire myself and my audience, or people I'm writing to or preaching to, or how do we do that?
Speaking from personal experience, as well as from my my career in teaching and pastoring people, to get instinctively aware, to make accessible, in my mind, the more subtle cultural assumptions that the authors of Scripture were drawing on all the time, is to immerse myself mm-hmm. in ancient Near Eastern Second Temple literature. And I actually, when I preach, Mike, all the time, I was reading to my congregation texts out of, in the old days, it was, you know, Pritchard's Ancient Near Eastern Texts. You know, now it's, you know, Hallow and Younger's Context of Scripture. But you read this stuff for yourself, and it transforms the way you read the Bible. And so I for myself and for my students, and even for a popular audience, I try to utilize the texts as much as possible. Another way that's often neglected, even by scholars, like, you know, people that spend their professions doing this, is we tend to ignore the iconography, the pictures, the picture mm-hmm. artwork from the ancient Near East. And the artwork is extremely important as a window into the assumptions of the ancient culture. And there are entire books written on artwork from the ancient Near East, and helping us to understand the clues that it gives us into the worldview and the assumptions mm-hmm. that people naturally had. So that's my encouragement, is just to get context of Scripture. Volume one, there's four volumes now, and it's expensive, but volume one's worth it for anybody, and it will change the way you read your Bible, and it enriches what relevance theorists call it, they use the term enrichment. It enriches the meaning of the text as that you read.
Yeah, I mean, in a less eloquent way, I just tell people that, look, there is no quick solution to this. You have to just keep, you got to keep doing it. You know, you have to keep reading it. You just have to absorb as much as you can with regularity. And eventually, that stuff's going to be floating around in your head.
Mm-hmm.
And it will inform, you know, your reading. You'll just become a more alert, a more careful reader, you know, of the ancient material, mm-hmm. Which is really important. Now, this is a total sidebar here, but this popped into my head, and you might know. Okay, now, you've got this fourth volume now of Context of Scripture, and you mentioned iconography. My audience is also familiar with the Dictionary of Deities and Demons in the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know anything about the iconographic material that is supposed to be published alongside the old DDD?
No, I'm afraid I don't.
Yeah, I don't either.
You know,
I see these little snippets like, oh, we're working on it, or oh, there's a little piece of it here and there, but it's almost like it's the Manhattan Project of biblical
studies.
Yeah, styles, you know?
You have already published in English. You've got Otmar Kiel, K-E-E-L. Yeah. You know this work, Mike. I'm just spelling it for mm-hmm. your audience. Otmar Kiel's work that goes back to the 70s, the biblical symbolism, and that's a great place to start. You could get that paperback probably for not very much money. There's another Uhlinger's Gods and Goddesses has a lot of iconographical material. You know, gives us pictures of seraphim and cherubim and all kinds of cool stuff. You know, changes the way you sing your Christmas carols. unfortunately, the granddaddy's coming out in three volumes of, I think, projected five volumes, but it's in German. And it is exhaustive. Yeah. It starts with the early Bronze Age. It's Schroer, S-C-H-R-O-E-R. Well, Kiel and Schroer did the first volume, and then Schroer, a student of his, she took on the subsequent volumes, and I cited in my book in the footnotes that it will be almost exhaustive for everything that the, you know, there's a whole school of thought, as you know, in Freiburg that has been doing nothing for decades but study ancient Near Eastern iconography, and that work is just now starting to come out. I just wish they would have published that first, that new set in English mm-hmm. Instead of German.
Who's the publisher?
If you really want to know.
I'm just wondering maybe you can tell me that if they are predisposed to also producing English translations of important things.
I am,
some publishers are, some are not.
I'm looking it up in the bibliography right now. Sylvia Schroer, Otmar Kiel, it is Academic Press of University of Freiburg that's doing that. Mm-hmm. So,
not a household name in supplying English.
No, not even a household name for us. Yeah, you know, right. That's, it's not like Brill or De Gruyter or something like that. So it's too bad. I should have mentioned, there's the volume that was the accompaniment that you know as well. I know. Pritchard's Ancient Near Eastern, instead of texts, it's called ANEP, Ancient Near Eastern Pictures. And there's a whole volume that's accompanying the text volume that's Ancient Near Eastern Pictures. And that, I mean, if that's a starting place, you probably get it pretty cheap used, mm-hmm. I would bet, out there. And that would be a great starting point for someone.
All right. I want to be sure to hit this. Let's transition to the accommodation issue, because we sort of flirted with that
mm-hmm.
In discussing, you know, the impact, really. I think how relevance theory can help us at least begin to think about what we're doing, you know, and again, how the communication process works, how the brain works. And those two things, of course, are related, because the brain is engaged when you're communicating, mm-hmm. at least it ought to be. What about accommodation, though? So, you know, you have ancient Near Eastern Second Temple material. It's discovered late. I mean, not discovered, but a lot of it's discovered late, and some of it was earlier. But the decipherment of the texts is, you know, 18th century, mostly 19th century and afterwards. So,
yeah.
By definition, you don't have a situation where you have the church fathers and major Christian traditions. You think of the Reformation tradition. They don't have that material. So how should we, since we do, and we know that they didn't, how should we handle the divergence between what the ancient biblical writers were trying to communicate and later interpretations of their material that lacked the ability, you know, to get into this, into their cognitive environment?
Yeah, I think that's a really important question, because it is, or it can be, I shouldn't say it is, it doesn't bother me, but it can be very unsettling to think that, you know, that God left the church to sort of flounder for 2,000 years with a, you know, with a misunderstanding of all kinds of cosmological texts and such. And what, you know, what do we do with that theologically? You know, poor Martin Luther, you know, he read the waters above, you know, the firmament, and given his Aristotelian worldview, you know, he read that text through the quote-unquote science of his day, and he thought the waters above the firmament were layers of ice between the spheres emanating, you know, that surrounded the geocentric, you know, Ptolemaic universe, and the waters were ice that lubricated the spheres as they spun very fast around the Earth. So he, you know, he's coming at it with his set of assumptions from his encyclopedic entry, and we look back at poor Luther and we laugh at him, and you know, the story goes on. But it's important to appreciate that God. Let's just take Genesis 1, just because that's, you know, the example that you know, I'm working with. God gave sufficient, it's called code, C-O-D-E, or we would say words. God gave sufficient wording in the text to communicate explicitly the fundamental theological notions that the Holy Spirit would have us learn from Genesis chapter 1 without having to enrich it from cognitive environment about geography, so that we, you know, we have always understood, the people of God from Moses on to the present day, the people of God have always been able to, you know, to look at that and see that there is a transcendent sovereign creator who has fashioned the elements of the universe into an orderly and good way that enhances the flourishing of life, and has placed us as humans at the apex of that as his representatives to continue to manage his order. And we get that, and always have, without having to worry about, you know, is the sun really bigger or the moon really bigger than the stars or not? And so the consolation in this is that God gives sufficient code, that is, explicit wording, to get the really essential important truths of the Bible without without enrichment. And throughout, you know, history, it's not just these ancient Eastern texts. We enrich the text with archaeology, material artifacts that come out of the ground, and so we are comfortable with the notion that God in his goodness is continuing to give us a broader insight into the world in which he spoke to us. And we can continue to enrich the meaning of the text with what we are discovering. And so for the ancient texts, you know, early to late 19th century, that we really have gotten onto this.
Yeah. So, you know, in short form, you know, they had a discoverable starting point. And, you know, the discoverable starting point that they had is really the core information that God in his providence knew that people would need, that would live long after the immediate audience, you know, that there's just going to be things in there that God once communicated. He lets the writers do that in the means accessible to them. You know, he doesn't change them into a different person. You know, I'm going to zap you, and now you're going to have a 21st century, you know, knowledge base now for the next 10 minutes. So start writing. You know, he doesn't change the authors. He lets them communicate in the ways that they can, knowing, again, providentially knowing and overseeing, you know, the process, so that the end result is going to be the core ideas that God really wants people to know at all times in all places are going to be transmittable. They're going to be discoverable. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean everything's discoverable. You know, and like I'm like you, you know, like that's a satisfying, you know, answer. And it's not just satisfying because, oh, you know, wipe my brow, I get to keep my theology now. It's satisfactory because that's the way life works.
Yeah.
Okay. You can't pick a subject and say, you know, and be at all coherent and say, well, since I can't know everything about sirloin tips, I'm never going to eat them again.
You know, since, good illustration.
Since I can't know everything about a subject, then I can't know anything. That's absurd.
Yeah.
Okay. Yep. And it's an absurdity that ripples out into life in every area. So I want the listener to know, you know, and we have obviously a friendly audience, but you know, you never know who listens to this thing. Mm-hmm. If you're you're stuck in this postmodern mindset that, well, since I can't know everything, and since my pastor doesn't know everything, and since Martin Luther didn't know everything, I guess we can't know anything. That's absurd. And you don't live your life that way either.
Right.
So let's just knock it off.
Yeah.
Let's just, you know, have an adult conversation here. And I want you to realize how unlivable that suggestion actually is. And then once that wraps around in your noggin a little bit, come back to earth and say, you know, this is just the way life is. You know, we have a limited knowledge of everything that we experience and do and enjoy and so on and so forth. And life can still be really good. We can enjoy it. We can understand things. Another way of saying it is we're not omniscient and we're not supposed to be, and we don't need to be.
Yeah, exactly.
So let's just stop, okay? Let's just stop with that. But I, you know, you run into, especially students, you know, young, you know, students that this is, whether consciously or unconsciously, they have been trained to think in this mode and they don't really see how unlivable and absurd it is. So let's cut the church fathers a break. They deserve it.
You know? Yep. Yep.
They deserve it. Luther.
Yep.
We appreciate them. We love them. They would be the first ones to admit with us that they're not omniscient either.
Yeah.
There might be something to add to what they said, and just move on and go from there and do the best job we can.
And we hope that the next generation of scholars after you and I are
is as
gone,
nice to us.
Yes, exactly. If the Lord tarries, that they are kind with us and our misinterpretations of who knows what.
Yeah, you know this is why, again, I have really two people always in my head for better or worse. You know, it's the people who send me the email that are losing their faith because of something like this.
Yeah.
You know, or the young student that they haven't even thought about why they think a thought.
Yeah.
And sort of where it errantly leads them, you know, the conclusions that, you know, to which that this aberrant thought leads them to. So when I think of those two audiences, like I said in an email after I read your book, I said, this book needs to be required.
Well, that's kind of you to say. Thank you.
Of all hermeneutics classes.
I only wish.
Yeah, you know, but you know, it does because it approaches a problem that everyone, you know, especially when you're forced in an academic context, you have to think about these things. But even in real life, and even if you can't sort of articulate it, you know that there's this communication problem thing. You know, we're not them. We're not the biblical writers. They weren't us. What do we do now? I mean, you just know this is a problem. But I don't know. I mean, you might be able to tell me if it exists. Like what hermeneutics textbook out there that is typically required? Which one does what we just talked about?
None of them.
None of them. I've taught Janine Brown a couple times. I don't know any of them.
Yeah, Janine Brown's book. I can't remember the title of it. It's a general interpretation of the Bible.
That's fairly
book. Fairly recent. And she has a chapter in there, and she doesn't even scratch the surface of relevance theory, but she brings it into the conversation to some extent. Other than that, you know, they just don't help us with a lot of these kinds of things.
Yeah, it's just one of those things that is so obvious, everybody stumbles over it, but then it's kind of like, you know, you're walking downtown and you trip, and then you look back and, oh, you know what, mm-hmm. you know, you stumble over it and then you just move on.
Well, I like to. on this accommodation thing, is what if you have time? Do we have time for one illustration?
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. I use the illustration of tomatoes as vegetables, and now maybe people already know this, probably do, but tomatoes are not vegetables. But there's this popular assumption that they are, and the popular assumption is reinforced by the fact that where do you find tomatoes in the grocery store? They're in there with lettuce and mushrooms, and I mean, you know, with other vegetables. And, we can ask ourselves a question. Why did the produce manager lie to me by putting tomatoes in the grocery section?
I'm never going to shop here again.
Yeah. But no, in fact, think of the poor, you know, what the grocer is trying to do is organize the produce section in a way that is optimized for my expectations when I walk into the store and I want to buy my vegetables and the things that go together in a salad. I buy those in one area. And so he's accommodating in an optimal way what my needs are and my expectations of relevance when I walk into the grocery store. Now, if the curator of a museum put tomatoes in the vegetable section of a botanical museum, I would have a problem with that.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not the case in the grocery store. And so there are certain assumptions that are just sort of incidental that in accommodation God has been willing to sort of set on the side for the sake of his love for us and adapting to our needs. And we don't think of them as errors in the Bible, because God's not trying to teach us about certain things in the text any more than the produce manager is trying to give us a botany lesson on where he puts tomatoes in the grocery store. Right. And so, I can relax and I don't worry about the truthfulness of God, because, his agendas are very difficult, actually, trying to communicate to Moses and to me with the same words. Mm-hmm. It's a very difficult thing that the Holy Spirit has taken on here to try to communicate to all of us in an optimal way that tells us truth and leave certain assumptions really unaddressed, which was necessary for the sake of optimal communication.
Yeah, well, I'm glad that we could do this. I'm glad you finished the project, because I, you know, when the book came out, I did remember, you know, having the conversation, you know, I don't know whose booth we were taking up, but somebody's booth.
Yeah, yeah, but, I remember that.
You know, I'm glad you saw the project through to its end, and that Wiffenstock, you know, took it on. And again, for the sake of our listeners, Trey will have the information about the book on the episode webpage, but you have to go to the Wiffenstock website, WIPFANDSTOCK.com. And once you're there, you find John's book, Old Testament. I want to make sure I get this right. Old Testament Cosmology and Accommodation.
Can you divine Old Testament Cosmology and Divine Accommodation, a Relevance Theory Approach.
Relevance Theory Approach is the subtitle. Yeah, you find the book. John's last name is HILBER, and put in the code DIVINE for 40% off. And I would highly encourage the audience to do this. Again, this is unique in hermeneutics, you know, Bible study sorts of textbooks. And it's just so essential to get you thinking about these things. You know, we do this almost every week on the podcast. You know, we talk about immersing yourself in the, you know, by whatever means, you know, in the cognitive environment. The worldview is a term I like to use a lot, of the ancient Near East for the Old Testament. You know, have the Israelite living in your head and the Second Temple Jew living in your head when you read the New Testament. This is a book that you can read, but you'll also sort of use to remind yourself of not only the necessity of this, but again, how this works with some good practical solutions to you know, be able to think through the whole process and the issue. So I just want to thank you, John, for being on with us. And, you know, Lord willing, you know, people will get your book and benefit greatly from it.
Well, Mike, thank you very much. It's been a fun conversation, and I hope and pray that people, you know, gain something from that and in their process. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you.
All right, Mike, another great interview. It boggles my mind that they don't teach this in hermeneutics class. I mean, the amount of, from what I'm understanding, that the textbook doesn't teach this stuff. It's not out there. So how can you teach it properly?
it's crazy. I had a hermeneutics class I actually had two hermeneutics classes as an undergraduate because I changed schools. So I actually had to take the class twice in college. And then I took a third one in seminary, and nothing like this, you know, in any of them, you know.
Why is that?
I've read several hermeneutics books. You know, I think really it was because they're, you know, I don't know how charitable do I want to be here. I think, I'm just going to say it. I think it largely has to do with the fear of exposing students that, or to the notion that a quote unquote literal reading is really not very serviceable. I think there's a fear of that, because that's typically what people get exposed to in churches, or, you know, whether they're coming as Christians into a college setting or as Christians into a seminary setting. That's typically the way we're taught to think. And then there's also the exposure to ancient Near Eastern thought, you know, this material that, you know, tends to be quite foreign to the average churchgoer, that would be unnerving. So I actually think that there's a fear element that prevented. I mean, hopefully John's book will change some things here, but I think the fear element prevents that content being given to a beginning seminary student or a beginning Bible college student. I think it's really that simple, which is really unfortunate, because if you don't get it there, where are you supposed to get it? You know, and then you can't transmit it either.
Hmm. Maybe it's time for you to write a hermeneutics textbook, Mike.
No. I got too many other things in the queue.
I don't know. Yeah, it seems like
take that phrase. It's time for you to, and just jettison it from your mind. Well, like I have.
well, maybe, you know, I feel like this context movement that's happening, maybe part of another part of the element of the movement is maybe some of that fear can go away. You know, maybe people can't be so scared of it. And so added this context, you know, movement that we're kind of in, that I think, you know, this podcast and others are spearheading, can be the first layer to remove that fear, you know, that you were talking about. So maybe that's the next phase.
I think you're right. I think you're right. And I think we're in that, you know, I think that's happening now, because, you know, to be honest about it, this podcast and, you know, a handful of others push the question. They're pushing the issue. You know, they're forcing people, you know, to deal with this, you know, and usually it's within churches, because, again, most of our listenership, we have a lot of pastors and you know, professors as well that listen to the podcast, but the bulk of our listeners are lay people, you know, who just love scripture. And we expose them to this, you know, it's pull the curtain back and, oh, there's the wizard, you know, moving the levers and pushing the buttons, you know, that, you know, we get into these things and it forces the discussion. So I think that's already happening. I agree with you.
All right. Good deal, Mike. Another great conversation. Well, congratulations again to the Old Testament and Revelation, official winner. So be looking forward to that in a few weeks. We still have a Q&A and another interview to get before we get to that book, but that gives you some time, Mike, to figure out where we're going to go in Revelation. I'm excited about that. I know everybody else is as well.
I can tell you we're going to start with Revelation 1:4. That's about all.
There you go.
And we might be there more than 1 week. It's amazingly dense, but we'll see. We'll see when we get there.
All All right. Sounds good. All right. Well, with that, I want to thank everybody for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.